It's Friday, so we will, of course, do the week. We'll do a little supply chain also because, of course, and we'll finish with some outdoor dining. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, the 22nd of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Lots of politics in the news this week. Negotiations, infrastructure, not to be ignored, to be sure. Also, some virus booster news, also not to be ignored. We, though, are going to stay in our lane as we try to do the economy and the 5 days that just were. Kate Davidson's at Politico. Brian Chung is at Yahoo Finance. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kate.
It's okay.
So, Kate, let me start with you. We have covered the Federal Reserve the last couple of days on this program, the ethics challenges that the central bank has faced, the fix that came out yesterday. And I guess we don't do a lot of takes on this program, but I guess I'd like your take on what's what at the central bank.
Well, I think that, you know, one comment I heard from folks yesterday is this is a pretty fast response, right? Mm-hmm. It was 40 some odd days ago that we first learned about this questionable trading activity. And the pressure has kind of mounted. You know, there were some stories earlier this week that are, you know, putting this issue a bit closer to the top officials at the central bank in Washington. Remember, it started with a couple of regional reserve bank presidents in Boston and Dallas. Mm-hmm. They had to step down. Then there were some revelations about some trades by the vice chairman, Richard Clarida. Another story this week about Chairman Powell. It seems like those issues are different and maybe not, you know, not as concerning, it would seem. But nevertheless, I think that this is you know, has provided fodder right now, especially to critics of, you know, of Chair Powell. Yeah. Progressives who think that he ought to be replaced by the president. You know, his term is ending in February, and so it's been a big question: what is Joe Biden going to do? Is he going to keep Powell? He's been, you know, pretty good. Some would say, you know, aligned with the president on monetary policy, it would seem. And I don't think that this helps him. But this was a pretty forceful response, and you know, even yeah. if there's more, even if critics would say there's more that needs to be done.
Brian, what do you think, first of all, about the tone deafness of these very senior Fed officials actually doing these trades at a time when the Fed was getting more involved in the economy than it's ever been, but also Kane's point about Chair Powell's future?
Well, make no mistake, this has been a massive PR disaster for the central bank, and it's never good when you're talking about the ethics rules at an institution that's supposed to be stabilizing policy, especially to the degree that they did when markets were really spinning out of control in 2020. But again, it seems like the action was relatively swift, as Kate was just laying out there. Both of those Fed presidents that were really in view, the Boston Fed president who had made trades in real estate investment trusts, and then the Dallas Fed president who had made stock trades in individual equities themselves, both of them had resigned pretty quickly thereafter. Of course, they called it retirement, but make no mistake that this probably came from the top. Now, when it comes to the optics of what this looks like from a political standpoint, yes, this is coming at a time when the Fed chairman's term as chair ends in February of next year. So the White House really needs to get moving soon on picking someone, whether or not that's Powell for renomination or someone else. But ultimately, I feel like the White House is probably just trying to see how this is going to play out. We saw yesterday the unveiling of these new rules. So maybe that's going to be the cap, if you will, on whether or not the White House feels that Powell made the right moves to earn a renomination. Mm-hmm. But of course, we saw some Republicans like the likes of Pat Toomey coalesce around him today, saying they were pleased by those actions. But whether or not that can whip together enough votes to get him renominated remains a question, with Elizabeth Warren calling him a dangerous man.
Kate, you wrote, I think this morning in Morning Money, which, by the way, is Kate's new newsletter at Politico, which she's taking over, which all y'all ought to subscribe to. I think you wrote that you think time is on Powell's side. The longer Biden's quiet, the more likely it is that Powell keeps his job.
You know, some people, smart people, were pointing out that, you know, first of all, you need to kind of get, if you're going to pick someone new at the Fed, you need to get markets acquainted with that person. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if Biden chooses to go with Lael Brainard, I mean, she's a known quantity. She's been on the board for a number of years, but this is a person who's going to be coming into a difficult situation next year. The cast of characters that's rotating onto the Fed's interest rate setting committee, they're more hawkish bullish. So they might be kind of taking, that is taking a different view than Powell. He's going to have to corral these views. They're talking about raising interest rates. That is going to be a difficult period. So it seems like if you want to have a whole new person, you really want to be like introducing that person very soon. And so the fact that the White House hasn't, they haven't even floated any trial balloons really of anyone to sort of gauge market reaction. I think people feel like that suggests, you know, that the job is Powell's to lose. And as Brian was saying, I think the White House maybe is just sort of waiting to see how the Fed, you know, maybe giving Powell a chance to respond to this ethics scandal. Yeah. And I think the response makes it a little more politically easier for them to say, you know, he's responded to this, he's dealing with it, right. We're going to renominate him. Right.
Okay, Brian, new topic. Talked a little bit on the program yesterday in light of the new pandemic low in first-time claims for unemployment insurance about the state of the American labor market. And we talked to some people who said, you know, this could be considered somehow, even though employment's at 4.8% and there's a zillion open jobs out there, could somehow be considered a tight labor market. And I wonder what you think about that.
Well, I think tight is a bit of an interesting word to use, because before COVID, what that really implied was that you met the equilibrium between the amount of workers that are available and the amount of jobs that are available. And I think right now, yes, we're maybe clearing from the perspective of there are people who are willing to work, who are finding jobs. There are plenty of jobs out there, we know. But what we still are trying to figure out are the people who have exited the labor market or temporarily exiting the labor market. Either way you cut it or slice it, the level of employment that we have now is 5 million jobs short of where we were in February of 2020. And that is far from a tight labor market, right? If you have 5 million people that had jobs in February 2020 and they don't anymore. So for the Fed, that's going to be a real challenge, because they're trying to figure out when to put their finger on the spigot to turn off monetary policy here. We know that tapering could begin as soon as that November meeting in about 2 weeks. That may not have as direct of an impact on the labor market as eventually raising interest rates, which won't happen this year. But the Federal Reserve still needs to be mindful of that, because you have inflation that's been going up. Now, raising interest rates might help that front. But if you raise interest rates with 5 million people still on the sidelines, maybe those people can't come back because employers won't be able to have the money and the capital in hand to bring them back in on their payrolls. That's going to be an open question for the probably 18 months in the future.
Right. Kate, super quick. We got like 45 seconds, maybe a minute left. Yesterday, a lot of reports out of the Biden administration about climate change. There was one from the National Security Establishment calling climate change a national security threat. Also one from the Financial Stability Oversight Council talking about climate change as a growing threat to the financial system. Talk about that for a second, would you?
Yeah, it's a big deal. I mean, it's the first time that U.S. financial regulators collectively in a formal way have kind of come out and said that this is their view, this is their position, that there are risks to the financial system. You know, banks have exposures to all kinds of things that could be disrupted by the changing climate. And so the question now is, what are they going to do about it? I think that climate advocates were hoping that the report would be a little more robust and laying out some, you know, some action. So far, they said, you know, we want to analyze this. We want to make sure that banks are taking these risks into account. But it didn't go quite as far, I think, as I said, as climate advocates hoped that it would.
Yeah. Kate Davidson at Politico Now, where she has taken over the Morning Money column. Again, all y'all ought to subscribe. And Brian Chung at Yahoo Finance. Thanks, you two.
Happy Friday.
Thanks so much, Kai.
On Wall Street today, mostly sideways. Again, actually, was a new record high on the Dow, I think. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Holiday shopping, as we all know, is going to be a mess. See also supply chain. Not yet mentioned much, though, holiday dinners. There's some new data out from IRI. They track product availability. And they say that supplies of some classic holiday favorites, liquid gravy, frozen pies, and related, perhaps, whipped toppings, are down as much as 11% compared to this time last year. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab covers food for us quite a bit.
For you to feed your family a big Thanksgiving turkey, first, the turkeys need to be fed. Brock Stein is president of Cuck's Turkey Farm in eastern Pennsylvania.
A Thanksgiving turkey eats between probably 70 and 100 pounds of feed before it goes to the plant.
And the price of feed, mostly corn, is up more than 50% from last year. Also, the birds are eating more because production is running slow. The company's processing plant is understaffed. Trucking is a problem.
You've got turkeys on the farms longer, eating, gaining weight.
Which means turkeys at the grocery store may be bigger this year. Stein's raised wholesale prices 10%. And it's not just the bird that's getting more expensive. Also bread, pies, and cakes. Rob Mackey at the American Bakers Association says members have been telling him.
From ingredients to packaging, equipment, electricity, distribution, and workforce cost, 49 of the 50 input costs that they track were up. Many of them are up double digits.
He says a lot of baking ingredients are stuck on those container ships. Did you know the U.S. imports about 80% of its wheat gluten? So much for amber waves of grain. And even if everything goes right, the growing, the harvesting, the processing, you can't put a product on the shelves if you have nothing to package it in. Katie Dennis at the Consumer Brands Association says aluminum costs are up almost 90%.
What that means is your canned cranberry sauce that makes that great sound when it slides out is going to cost a little bit more.
Now, there's no reason to panic buy. Everyone I spoke to for the story says there won't be a shortage of turkeys or trimmings this year. But they'll likely cost more, and you may have to be flexible with brands. And maybe this is a controversial take, but if all else fails, you could always make the cranberry sauce from scratch. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
So as I said, we talked a little bit on the program yesterday and today with Brian Chung about the labor market and its tightness or not tightness in this very peculiar moment in this economy. It is just tough for companies to find enough people to hire for lots of reasons. Yes, all of which we have discussed. So some business groups are looking to broaden the labor pool by bringing in people who might have been previously overlooked, those with criminal records for minor offenses who often lose out on a job after a background check. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has that one.
Advocates for so-called clean slate laws often cite an estimate that 1 in 3 American adults has a criminal record, whether it's a felony, a minor misdemeanor, or just an arrest. Take Joshua York.
When I was about 16, I was just in and out of detention centers. I was smoking pot with my friends.
York racked up several misdemeanor charges in Utah over the ensuing years. Now, at 29, he's gotten his life together. But those charges, including drug possession and retail theft, have kept him from being able to get good-paying jobs.
Every job has looked back at my record once they did a background check, and they would see a theft, and they would say, I'm sorry, there's just no way. It would literally take me out of the running immediately.
So York made do with low-paying manual labor work. For years, he had no idea that Utah allowed former offenders to apply to get their records cleared.
Many states across the country has a mechanism to clear your record.
But most people don't take advantage of those mechanisms, says Sheena Mead. She's the executive director of the Clean Slate Initiative. For the last couple of years, there's been a nationwide campaign trying to get laws passed to make the record clearing process automatic, so people who are eligible never have to think about it. The process uses technology that's a part of so much of our lives these days, algorithms. These are created by another nonprofit called Code for America. Sheena Mead says the implications of automating the record clearing process are huge, especially for people of color.
Black and brown people specifically has been impacted are the ones that have been paying for decades of over-criminalization, criminalizing and incarcerating people for failed initiatives like the war on drugs.
Pennsylvania was the first to implement a clean slate law starting 2 years ago. And officials say more than 1 million people have had their records cleared without filing a single application. Utah is next. It's expected to implement its clean slate law by the end of the year. In the 5 states that have passed such laws, there has been bipartisan support for them. Business groups, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, are backing the idea too.
As the labor shortage has gotten worse, the business community has really started taking great interest in broadening their talent pool to include people who have made mistakes in the past.
That's Jeffrey Korzenik, chief investment strategist at Fifth Third Bank. He's written a book about hiring people with criminal records called Untapped Talent. Even though businesses are eager for a bigger talent pool, Korzenek says they're often reluctant to simply overlook criminal records on background checks.
The question for the business community becomes, what sort of risks are they taking from a legal standpoint? What kind of reputational risks are they taking? And that's where you have a huge social stigma to overcome.
Korzenek says businesses are also worried about liability risks, however minor. So clearing people's records through clean slate laws is something businesses can get behind because it avoids them having to deal with all those issues. Joshua York's years-long effort to clear his record ended successfully just 3 months ago, and he says it's made a big difference.
I'm in the best spot I've ever been in my entire adult life, and I'm literally just so thankful. I wake up kind of still blown away that I can apply to a job that I'm not afraid to anymore, you know?
York ended up getting an offer for the kind of job he says he's always wanted. In early November, he's scheduled to start training to be a customer service representative for American Airlines. I'm Novosavo for Marketplace.
Coming up.
This will heat up your beer if you don't drink it fast enough.
Don't drink warm beer. Just don't. That's it. That's the promo. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 73 points today, about 0.2%, 35,677, a record high. The NASDAQ gave up 125 points, about 0.8%, 15,090. The S&P 500 down 4, about 0.1%, 45.44. For the week, the Dow added just shy of 1.1%. The NASDAQ pocketed 1.3%. S&P 500 up 1.6%. Facebook down 5% today. I wonder what it's going to be called in like 10 days, huh? Twitter gave back 4.8%. One social media company that did not fall? Allow me to introduce you to Digital World Acquisition Corporation, which more than doubled in price today, up 107%. That is a day or so after announcing it would be the home of former President Donald J. Trump's new social media platform, Truth Social. That's what it's called. I report. You decide. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Climate change. It is a catastrophic problem. So we got to control fossil fuels, coal especially, right? Well, yes, but also plastics. There is a report out this week that says if current production trends hold, by the end of the decade, plastics and the plastics production chain could be a bigger source of greenhouse gases in the United States than coal. We have been talking a lot on this program about greenhouse gases from cars and from heating buildings and how we got to get to electric cars and renewable energy. But plastics? What do you do about that? Marketplace's Amanda Petra has that one.
The report calls plastic the new coal. That's because of the process and petrochemicals that go into making it in the U.S.
The equivalent of 116 average coal-fired power plants.
Judith Enck is with Beyond Plastics at Bennington College, which produced the report. With so much talk about electric vehicles and renewable energy these days, Enck says a lot of people don't realize petrochemical production is on the rise in the U.S. She says it's where oil companies are investing now.
Plastics is the plan B for the fossil fuel industry.
That's because Americans use a lot of plastic, says economist Jeffrey Morris with Sound Resource Management Group.
Pervasive because it's quite convenient and it's useful in a lot of especially durable applications.
Durable and cheap. Morris says the trend of rejecting single-use plastics like cutlery and straws is a good start. The European Union banned these in July. And so did Lisa Hecht in Boise, Idaho, in her own home.
I'm really into mason jars.
But plastic still creeps into her life, Hecht says. Take the phone book, a huge block of paper, shrink-wrapped.
You know, even if I say I don't want it, they throw it on my porch.
As economist Jeffrey Morris said, plastic is everywhere. And changing that will take a lot of mason jars and more. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
Outdoor dining has been quite literally a lifeline for a lot of bars and restaurants the past 19 months. And since you got to spend money to make money, a lot of places spent not small amounts of money making those outdoor spaces as habitable as possible. But to everything, there is a season, and outdoor dining might not be that thing as winter draws close, as Brita Green reports now from St. Paul, Minnesota. Yes, Minnesota. And outdoor dining in the winter. Here you go.
One of the oldest buildings in St. Paul is home to Waldmann, a German-style restaurant and brewery. Walk onto the patio, and it's easy to miss what looks like a simple set of light switches mounted on the wall. Owner Tom Schroeder clicks them on.
What we have here are 8 35,000 BTU infrared heaters. That are specifically designed to operate in high winds.
There are more heaters in other areas, too. Stand nearby, and within about 5 minutes, Schroeder says, you'll start to feel the warmth on your clothing and any exposed skin.
And in fact, this will heat up your beer if you don't drink it fast enough.
That's maybe one downside, he says. But really, having these heaters will help ensure that he'll have customers here all winter long.
Oh, yeah. The beer garden was packed, if you can imagine, last New Year's Eve. It was 5 below.
He says he invested just over $60,000 in this equipment in 2020. Says it was well worth it last winter, and he anticipates it'll be worth it this year, too. According to a recent survey by a group representing the hospitality industry in Minnesota, about 2/3 of Minnesota restaurants have taken on debt since the start of the pandemic, the average amount being about $500,000. In Minneapolis, Christina Nguyen hasn't spent nearly that much to invest in outdoor seating at her restaurant, Hi-Hi. She estimates she spent a couple $1,000s to put up a tent and some decorations alongside what was already a big permanent patio. She intends, though, to move everything indoors once temperatures dip into the 20s and 30s.
I would be lying if I said that I was looking forward to fall and winter coming because, you know, as the patios close, we're definitely going to be feeling it.
She says it's hard to believe this winter could be as bad as last before vaccinations were available. Still, restaurants here are not required to ask patrons for proof of vaccination for indoor dining. That's one reason that Zach Eichten decided to meet friends outdoors at St. Paul Brewing. He says he prefers restaurants to have vaccine mandates if he's going to venture inside.
But outside works great for places that don't have policies like that in place.
The patio here is packed, even though it's damp and in the 50s. Chelsea Fye says it's her third time here in a month.
I mean, here in Minnesota, you acclimate to the cold, as we say. So I don't feel like this is cold right now. It's jacket weather for sure.
The bar inside, which does not have a vaccine mandate, is busy as well. Catering to both crowds, this brewery plans to heat the outdoor space this year once temperatures dip a bit further. Director of Operations Tony Perella says the propane for those heaters alone will cost about $500 a week. And for new restaurant owners, those kinds of outdoor costs are just part of the business model. Chef Yi Vang is planning to open a new restaurant next year. When he first started putting together the designs for the space, Vinay, in Minneapolis, the patio was an afterthought.
And now it's like, oh, wow, like the outdoor seating aspect of it has to be as big, if not, you know, one of the bigger draws now.
He says customers are roughly split in terms of their comfort eating indoors, and best business practice is to have options for all. In St. Paul, I'm Brita Green for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which I just honestly, what? Should you be so inclined, and again, what? Royal Caribbean's got a new cruise offering 274 nights afloat. 274 nights, that is 9 months. I'll do the math for you. All seven continents, 65 countries. The world cruise of world cruises, the company says. Oh, how much, you ask? $60,000 a head to start. All right, we got to go. Not before, though, your moment of economic context, and we are going to end on an upbeat note on Friday. Some data out from the Census Bureau last week that shows new business formation, specifically new businesses that are likely to hire employees, likely employer businesses, they are cleverly called. That is a specific category. Anyway, 1.4 million of them through September of this year. That is the most through the third quarter of any year since they started keeping track. Why do I mention it? Because as I said the other day, jobs are the whole smash in this economy right now. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.